there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Don. I'm Dr. Don Motika, your host for this hour of debate, dialogue, healthcare, and science in the news, and answers to your questions via email and telephone. But before I do that, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, we don't usually talk about global climate change in the context of healthcare, and yet the science of global climate change tells us that regardless of the source, and that's, of course, the basis of a lot of debate, regardless of the source, temperatures are going up. Record temperatures are being seen everywhere. Ice caps are melting. Sea levels are rising. And one of the areas the most vulnerable is the Gulf Coast of the United States. We saw with Katrina and the storm surge what a big hurricane and flooding can do and how long-term disruptive it can be for a city. Well, it's not just New Orleans who's at risk for this. Projections put Miami underwater by 2050, depending upon which models you apply. And even if that doesn't happen, anyone living along a waterfront in Florida, and Arkansas, Louisiana as well, is at risk, substantial risk, for disruption from storms. And the storms, well, they'll be getting bigger as any perturbed system will have larger fluctuations. So that talks about the water and the displacement. And of course, living in a swamp or living in an area that's knee-deep in dirty water is an extremely unhealthy environment. And stagnant water leads to an increase in mosquitoes. And depending on the temperature, and if it's just a couple of degrees warmer, then all of those diseases like malaria and dengue, which are rare in the continental United States, start to become commonplace. So as a society, we need to acknowledge that this sort of change is coming, and we need to beef up our disaster management. We need to focus very carefully on how we're going to respond as a country when these things happen. We need better evacuation plans. We need essentially, I think, established evacuation centers with good housing. That was one of the problems with the evacuees from Katrina, is that many of them were put into mold-damaged temporary buildings, which made their health worse. They'd already been exposed to waterborne organisms, and then they got to live in a house full of mold. Very substantial injuries occurred, and of course, many people are still suffering the ill effects of these circumstances. We really cannot afford to be improvisational in our response to large population displacements. They will be occurring. And I want to urge all of you to step out of the Democratic and Republican debates, step out of the next 2 years in terms of your thinking, and look long term. Support projects that are addressing the long-term infrastructure that we're going to need to deal with the coming displacements, because quite honestly, it's not other people's problem. You could yourself very easily, no matter how big a McMansion you live in, be one of these displaced individuals. And the need to treat everyone humanely and keep them safe is part of our social responsibility as citizens of a collective society, and we need to put some energy and time and resources into planning for what is inevitable, which is to say, mass migrations and disruptions. A look at the riots and the things going on in Greece, at the border between France and England. You are looking at the future when you look at that, except those are isolated, relatively small situations. Imagine when the number of people on the move is in the millions, not in the hundreds of thousands. We need to think about how we're going to manage this, and we certainly need to think about housing and food stores. So, bringing it back home, we live in earthquake country here in Northern California. So let me just ask you, have you a water supply that's going to last you, I would say, at least a week? And that's assuming that the disaster people aren't dealing with six other disasters. But let's just say a week, maybe 2 weeks to be really safe. Do you have food supplies and fuel to cook that food? Do you have a two-week backup of critical medications? That's probably the single most important one. And because of our insurance system, that gets neglected because they only dole out 30 days at a time. It's important for you to have a two-week advance supply of your insulin, of your heart pills, of all of those things. And if you need to purchase them over time, and then turn them over so they don't outdate. In other words, use your purchased ones. That puts you 2 weeks ahead on your prescriptions as far as your insurance company is concerned. So then you're always 2 weeks ahead when you refill your prescription. This is a really good idea, and it's something all of us can implement. You might be able to get that two-week supply by asking your doctor for samples. That's a certainly an appropriate question to ask. And really, honestly, this is something that everyone should be doing right now. Little latches on the cupboards of the china cabinet isn't a bad idea either. But this one, you know, you can sweep up broken dishes, but getting drugs that you need to stay alive, well, that's something that you'd better take care of. So just a little earthquake advice here on Ask Dr. Don. Our next story is about transplant patients and about recent research showing that anyone undergoing an organ transplant is twice as likely to develop melanoma after the transplant and three times more likely to die of it. Well, we know that immune reduction drugs, immune suppressant drugs, are used to prevent organ rejection, and that's part of the puzzle. But what's interesting is that this is not a late change, it's an early change. So within the first 4 years after treatment, the risk of aggressive melanoma, metastatic melanoma, was surprisingly high in transplant patients. This is probably because these patients had a small melanoma that was unidentified at the time of their transplant. So it's extremely important if you're going to be getting a kidney transplant, a heart transplant, any transplant at all, to have a very thorough professional dermatological examination. And with all due respect to primary care physicians, because I am one and I think I'm pretty good at spotting skin cancers, I wouldn't bet on me if I was dealing with these kind of odds. You want someone to go over your skin with a fine-tooth comb and biopsy anything that even sneezes, so to speak, because a melanoma that might easily be fought off by your immune system is not going to be if you are on these immunosuppressive drugs. Now, the other types of skin cancers, squamous cell, basal cell, also go up, not surprisingly, in people who are on immunosuppressive drugs. But the curves on those suggest that that's just ongoing development of cancers that don't get defeated by the immune system, suppressed immune system, and therefore are able to succeed. This is also seen, by the way, in the antibodies, the monoclonal antibodies against tumor necrosis factors that are used for diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and lupus. Now, these are horrible diseases, and you need to treat them when they're disabling. But when you take one of these medications, an immunosuppressant medication of either flavor, you are interfering with your body's ability to fight off cancer, as well as interfering with your disease. So increased surveillance, increased vigilance, regular dermatologic visits, and an understanding that there is a price for for your improved function. And we're going to our first caller, and that's Elizabeth in Aptos. Hello, Elizabeth, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
How are you this morning?
I'm well.
I have a question that might be useful to other people at this time of year. I was in a situation this week where I should have been using sunglasses, and I didn't. And so my eyes have been sensitive to light ever since. Now, I think it's improving, so I assume there's not permanent damage, but I just wanted your take on anything I can do nutritionally or otherwise to work with that.
Oh, what an interesting question. Okay, so antioxidants, and the big ones would be vitamin C and vitamin E orally. And vitamin C in particular has has good properties for sunburns. And effectively, I think you have a kind of cornea burn, and that has made your eyes sensitive and possibly just actually when you walk from dark to light, do your eyes hurt?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so the pupil itself is, it's like having a sore muscle. And the pupil, which expands and contracts, it is a muscle after all, although we don't think of it as that. The pupil's the hole in the iris. So more accurately, what I should be saying is that the iris is a muscle. It's a pretty colored muscle, and it expands and contracts and in response to light. And when it's sore, movement makes it hurt. So you have inflammation of the ciliary body, the iris, in other words, and probably irritation of the cornea as well. It will heal. Lubricating eye drops are helpful. Sunscreen is helpful. And just to kind of throw something out, I really recommend polarized lenses. As opposed to the ones that, to the 100% UV protection lenses, polarized lenses reduce the light substantially, but they allow you to adapt better to changes in light going into a building, coming out of a building, and also they help the aging eye see more clearly, and that's a great benefit. So I'm a fan of polarized sunglasses, which are available fairly cheaply, a $20 pair of sunglasses as opposed to a $5 pair, which most of us can swing the difference. Although I have to admit, they're dowdier. There aren't as many cool-looking ones.
I actually wear glasses, and so I have those little flip things, because otherwise you have to buy a $200 pair of prescription sunglasses.
Right, right, exactly.
And a dilemma to even find those flip ones. But
yeah.
I appreciate the input. That's very helpful.
Yeah, and so even now, some oral vitamin C would probably be beneficial. But just for the audience, even eating more oranges or foods that have vitamin C is a great way to get vitamin C. But if you don't like oranges or you can't, or you're allergic to citrus, taking 500 or 1,000 milligrams a day when you're going to be sun exposed can actually reduce the severity of sunburn, as ironically enough can taking an ibuprofen after you've been in the sun.
Oh, interesting. Huh.
So, helpful hints.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for an interesting call. Have a great day. Bye-bye. Let's go now to Susan in Moss Landing. Hello, Susan. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
About a couple of weeks ago, I had it was actually exciting because it involved fire, ambulance, and, all those people. And I was taken to the hospital with all the symptoms of heart attack. And I think that the little machine that has the wavy line, I think the paramedic said something about that. Anyway, I was given nitroglycerin two or three times, and I was released the next day. They hadn't found anything. I guess they did a sonogram, mm-hmm. and I guess they didn't do any blood test after about 6 hours. Didn't show anything, and I was told to go see my family practice doctor. So when I saw him a couple of days later, and I was telling him and trying to all these symptoms, all this stuff about having a heart attack, after talking to him for a long time, I mentioned that because of the shoulder issue, I was to like taking meloxicam. And he looked at me and said, "Who gave you that? Why are you taking that? And stop taking it." He said that some of these NSAIDs, they can mimic heart attack, and I confirmed that with my RN sister-in-law, mm-hmm. and my endocrinologist the next week essentially said the same thing, and that they may change the warning signs that might cause, to will cause myocardial infarction. So now I'm confused. If I ever filled out a health thing, am I supposed to say that I had, I don't know if I had a mild heart attack or not. I don't even know what to put down.
Well, I'll tell you, if you had a mild heart attack, you probably wouldn't have gotten out of the hospital the next day.
So a
standard thing that happens with a heart attack nowadays is, let's walk through the rule out MI, the acute coronary syndrome, because we stopped calling it heart attack because we were rescuing so many people from an actual heart attack. So we changed the name to acute coronary syndrome. So let me walk you through what that is. Person's walking around, boodling along, suddenly they get a little crack in the blood vessel wall. That crack exposes compounds that absolutely should not be in contact with the blood. And the minute those compounds, structural and collagen and things like that, are in contact with the blood, the platelets, who are these tiny little cells, just pile up like linebackers on a football on that crack. They just start building up, building up, building up, building up, sticking to each other. And of course, they're forming a lump in the middle of the pipe. And that lump starts to block the blood flow. And the person that heart is in starts to have cramping, kind of a Charlie horse in their heart. And they usually experience it as a sensation of sharp pressure. But there's a pressure component to it in most cases. Now, because the heart is covered by a bag called the pericardium, and the pericardium is innervated by the same nerve that innervates the diaphragm and the shoulder, you get pain in the shoulder and sometimes nausea and vomiting. Women in particular get nausea and vomiting. Men tend to get more pain in the shoulder and pain in the jaw on the left side. And so those are the circumstances that we've gone out of the way to teach the public to be alert for. And if you have these things, consider this a heart attack until proven otherwise. So totally appropriate to go to the emergency room. When you arrive in the emergency room with these characteristic symptoms, you will have a blood test called a troponin drawn. And a troponin is a very sensitive protein assay. This protein leaks out of damaged heart cells. So when there is damage to the heart cells, then you'll see elevations of troponin in the bloodstream. Similar to when there's damage to the liver, you'll see liver enzymes go up in the bloodstream. Same sort of thing. So we know there's cells that are leaking, and that would be suggestive of a heart attack. So then they would wait and check it again in 6 hours. And if it's still down, still zero, still normal, then that pain is very evidently not heart attack. And we don't go any further. On the other hand, if that first troponin is elevated, then they're going to get on the phone and they're going to call the cardiologist. And that individual is going to get dye put in their veins, put in their artery. And you're going to take quick little pictures while the dye flashes through the heart to look at the pipes and see where the blockage is.
Once is that the calcium score test?
No, that's not the calcium score test. This is called an angiogram. And what happens normally during the angiogram is if you find that blockage, you find that clot, then you're going to go in there with a little thing called a stent. It looks rather like a Chinese finger trap, and it's on the catheter. And when they get it into position, they pop it open, and it mushes down the plaque, which is still, at this point, the clot is soft because it's piled up platelets and secondary fibers that form from bloodstream factors called clotting factors. And so it's platelets lashed together with little ropes, and it's soft, so you can mush it. And you mush it back, and that opens up the pipe, and now blood flow is restored to the heart before you lose heart muscle, before heart muscle dies. Now, before we had this kind of approach, the clot would happen, the blood flow would stop, the heart muscle that was served by that pipe would suffocate, effectively, die of lack of oxygen, and then you would have a scar on your heart, and then that was a true heart attack. So with no elevation in troponin, we know that you didn't have a heart attack. Normally what happens before they let you out of the hospital is some kind of stress test, maybe an ultrasound stress test in a woman where you walk on a treadmill.
I did that.
And then they lie you down and look at your heart. And there, what they're looking for is evidence of blockage that isn't a blood clot, but is just a blockage from plaque. And that'll show up either as electrical changes while you exercise, or it'll show up as poor movement of part of the heart. When they look at the ultrasound, the part of the muscle that isn't getting enough blood will be sluggish, and so it won't contract well. So I can infer, since they sent you home, that you did not have any evidence for a blockage. There is a type of spasm that occurs called Prinzmetal's angina, P-R-I-N-Z, and Prinzmetal's angina, common in women, and the blood vessels spasm, and it causes characteristic chest pain and is benign, if you put that in quote marks, because we don't associate it with myocardial death, but it's still very unpleasant. And often we will give people drugs to prevent the spasm of the blood vessels because it is, you know, as I said, very unpleasant. The issue with the non-steroidals is complicated. Everything they said was true, but the impression they gave you was not true. So let me kind of unpack that a little. The fact is, if you take any kind of aspirin, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, meloxicam being one of them, this prevents you from making protective stomach mucus. And so you will get more heartburn and you will get more stomach aches. And stomach aches, if especially heartburn, can go up the sternum underneath the breastbone and mimic a heart attack because the esophagus is served by the same nerve that's covering the pericardium. So all of these pains are signals. They're signals from different areas in the same region, and the brain interprets the pains the same way. And so it can be confusing. It doesn't really localize well. So that's one thing. And that's around the non-steroidals, is that they can give you esophagitis and that can mimic a heart attack. The other thing is that the FDA just changed the warnings recently on non-steroidals, saying that they could increase the chances of having a heart attack. And this is true, and I've been working on how to present this, and I think I'm sort of ready to try this on, so bear with me. I know this is a long answer, but hopefully it's informative. There are two opposing forces in our blood vessels. There's thromboxin, another chemical whose name I am blanking on, that is the opposite and lives in the blood vessel wall. And the thromboxin is on the platelets and makes them stickier. And the other compound is is the opposite. It actually helps the blood flow better. So when you have this dynamic opposite of these two, you end up basically in a tug of war. When you take non-steroidals, you tend to block both of these at different durations. So at the end of the day, the thromboxin is not blocked for as long by the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And so because it comes back sooner, there's more blood clotting going on for part of the 24-hour day cycle. So it actually has an unintended procoagulant effect when you take non-steroidals. So it's a relatively higher probability of blood clotting occurring. The amplitude of this effect is not that great, but it's enough that it statistically does tilt things in favor of more heart attacks in people using the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories compared to people using using aspirin products, for example. So you can see how the doctors, being aware of both of these things, kind of blended them there. I would say that the magnitude of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory effect is fairly small, and really only people who have already had heart attacks or who know that they have, you mentioned a coronary calcium score, people with a very high coronary calcium score, people with a very negative family history, they may want to avoid taking these anti-inflammatories on a regular basis.
My calcium score was zero. They did that test.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're probably very low risk, but I don't know all of the details of your clinical situation. But I was just trying to elucidate what the meloxicam thing was about. So mimicking your symptoms is probably the more important piece of it, because we know you didn't have a blood clot.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
You're very welcome, and thanks for giving me a chance to elucidate all of that complex stuff.
Thank you. Bye.
Have a good day. Oh, and it's come back to me now. It's thromboxane and prostacycline. Let's go to Jean in Pacific Grove. Hello, Jean, and welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Don.
How are you?
I am well. And my question is, how well am I? Anyway, I had recently I had a another fecal occult test, and they always come out negative.
Yes.
However, I knew it would come out negative because it looks good and I'm regular and all that good stuff. But I do have blood at the end. So when you're doing the test, you know, you're getting it right away. At the end, I'm having some blood. And my doctor told me years ago that, like most people, I have hemorrhoids. So I'm betting on hemorrhoids. And the reason I'm talking about this is because I haven't had a colonoscopy, and I'm always putting it off because there's no, that I know of, any cancer history in my family. And I'm 70 now, so I'm wondering, I told my doctor, I said, you're going to be still recommending it when I'm 80, and he said, oh, we're not. And so, anyway, I'm wondering, the older I get?
Well, the older you get, it's not that your chances, it's kind of like prostate cancer. It's not that your chances of getting cancer are reduced. In fact, they're increased, but your chances of dying of the cancer are reduced because you're more likely to, number one, you're more likely to die of something else. And number two, in the case of actually both colon cancer and prostate cancer, you know how your cells aren't as peppy and your skin's kind of saggy and you move a little slower when you're 70 than you did when you're 50?
Well, there's a little slower in there.
Yeah, well, the cancers move slower too. The cancer cells are old, so they aren't as aggressive either. And statistically, at least, and as we move in our stumbling, random walk fashion towards some kind of national health system, people are starting to do risk-benefit analysis for all of these things and going, you know, do we? And it's a fair question, you know, how we die. I think there was I think that's the book by Atul Gawande that came out recently. And it's, do you want to die at 85 with them shocking your heart in the intensive care unit, you know, with a ventilator tube down your throat? Yeah, probably that's a ridiculous way to die at 85. Now, if you're 45 and you've got 40 good years that you're losing, then that's an appropriate way to die because it's, you've got a lot to lose. But when you're almost at the end of the line, does it make sense to treat the cancer? Does it make sense to even go looking for the cancer? And that's why they stop. That's why these, you know, no mammograms after 70 or no colonoscopies after 70, or, you know, you're starting to see those proposals being floated with the idea that it really won't matter to the lifespan of the individual. So why are we putting them through this invasive and and somewhat dangerous test? I mean, people, one in 5,000 or one in 10,000, depending on which study you read, people who get a colonoscopy will get a perforation and end up in the hospital for a few days. It's rare that anyone dies from them, but it's still a fairly significant complication.
Does my idea of hemorrhoids make sense?
Well, sure. I mean, that hemorrhoids are always kind of annoying because then you can't use the FIT cards, the fecal immunoglobulin test, to look for stool. And that is a good test. If you do that every year, it is as good for survival purposes as cancer. And in fact, I was getting ready to prepare a topic on this, so I might as well say the fecal immunoglobulin test has annually is considered equivalent to a colonoscopy every 10 years. But you can't do that test because you're going to have positives.
Well, now, I never had a positive.
Well, that's good, given that you've got hemorrhoidal bleeding, because it causes a lot of false positives.
Oh, really? So, because the blood's only after I've gone to the bathroom.
Right, so the front end of the stool doesn't have blood on it, and that's a very good sign. If you wanted to hedge your bet, you could get, there is a blood test that a lot of people don't know about. It's called Colovantage, C-O-L-O, and then advantage like advantage.
Yeah.
And it's a test for something called the SEPT9 gene, S-E-P-T-9. And it's in the bloodstream. So you can, and this is only made by cancer cells. So you can test your blood for a protein that is only made by cancer cells. And therefore, if that protein's in your blood, there's trouble in River City. So if it's not in your blood, that isn't proof you don't have cancer, because it's only about 70% accurate. So it's only present in about 70% of cancers. So you don't see it in everyone. But if you don't have stool tests, if you have negative stool tests and you have this test negative, you know, I feel like that's pretty darn good about, and that stalling on the colonoscopy is a reasonable thing to do. Colonoscopy is by far the most accurate way to diagnose polyps and precancerous lesions and all of that, and it has a sensitivity of close to 90%, meaning that only 10% of cancers get missed, as opposed to 70%, which means 30% of cancers get missed. But if you do two tests that both are 70% sensitive, and they're sensitive to different things, then you're probably getting close to 90% with the overlap. And so I think you're a free agent, and you can, you know, do some research and make your own decisions.
My doctor knows I'm doing that. I have one other question, and going back to the previous one with the woman with the heart thing and everything. As I understand it, I don't take any drugs, and I understand now that they're even lowering the recommended levels for taking statins. And I've resisted those all along, and I've been on the, I guess my test, whatever the test is, have always been right there at the border of it. So I guess if they've lowered it even more, they'll say I'm in it now. Although my doctor's never recommended statins to me.
Well, without knowing your numbers, I'll comment more generally on this.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of theys. So which they you listen to will really make a difference in which advice you take. The cardiologists seem to be running very, very scared and putting everybody on a statin that's breathing, because they're being blamed for heart attacks unless the individual is on a statin when there's a heart attack. Now, this is an absolute fact that over half of the people who have heart attacks have no cholesterol risk factors for heart attack. They have normal cholesterol. Half of heart attacks are in people who would not qualify for a statin by any criteria. So by cholesterol criteria. And here it gets better. If you take people who have normal cholesterol and put them on a statin, you do see fewer heart attacks. But it's not because you lowered their cholesterol. Because the problem is not and never has been cholesterol. Cholesterol is a marker that was discovered back before we knew anything about the physiology of heart attacks. And so because it was a marker, and there were these few people, these families, where everybody in the family got a heart attack. And so it was like, oh, what is it about this family? And, oh, they've got sky-high cholesterol. And they made the cause and effect, you know, cholesterol causes heart attacks, connection in these pathologic individuals who had abnormal physiologies. And in them, yes, that is absolutely true. Their cholesterol levels are so high that the normal amount of inflammation will allow them to form plaques. But that is not normal human physiology. These are families of mutants. But they made the wrong conclusion based on studying the mutants. And they applied it to everybody. And then they then the statins came along, and they started giving statins to people. And yeah, you know what? If you've had a heart attack and I give you a statin compared to the guy who had the heart attack who doesn't take a statin, the second heart attack is much rarer It's like half as many second heart attacks in the people on statins, and that's yoo-hoo, wow, great. We can prevent second heart attacks. But it's still not about cholesterol. It's about inflammation. And that's the key thing. That's why the group that doesn't have any risk factors on cholesterol, like the people with a high coronary calcium score. By the way, the reason that a lot of calcium in your arteries is bad is because your arteries are brittle. And the plaque will break easily. And remember what I said about the woman, the plaque breaking is what gets the platelets to jump on it to form the clot. And that's the necessary trigger. It doesn't happen without that plaque breaking. So more stiff plaque, more breakage, more lottery tickets in the heart attack lottery, but without having any elevated cholesterol. And the reason that statins work is because they're anti-inflammatory agents. And inflammation is the thing that triggers the formation of plaque. So without inflammation, plaque does not occur. Plaque is a combination of factors. You have to have inflammation. You have to have small cholesterol particles that act as the raw material. You have to have these foam cells present that eat the small cholesterol particles, which have to have a charge on them. They have to be oxidized, or this doesn't even happen. So it's like the immune cells actually think that the oxidized little cholesterol particles are bacteria, and they're trying to take bacteria out of the bloodstream, so they're eating them. If the particles are large, then the immune cells don't mistake them for bacteria. And if the particles don't have a charge on them, then they don't get anywhere near the immune cells, so the immune cells never see them. So the anti-inflammatory effect of the statin, which is actually where the benefits comes in. So you could say quite legitimately that everybody should be on a statin because it's an anti-inflammatory, and it is a true statement. The problem is statins are not without their downsides, and if you track the onset of statins when we started giving them out, and you look at congestive heart failure, what you see is just like we see with childhood obesity starting in the 1980s and then childhood diabetes in the 1990s. We see this relentless upward march of congestive heart failure in this country. And we see it, and the timing goes beautifully with the statins. And one of the things that statins do as a side effect is they interfere with mitochondria. They deplete you of CoQ10, which you need in your mitochondria to make energy. So essentially, you are potentially, and I do actually believe this is true, but I am speaking on the basis of physiology and not on the basis of a placebo-controlled double-blind study, which is the standard of excellence in science, so I want to qualify my remarks. But it's extremely fishy, and I think that nobody should be on a statin without taking CoQ10, and I worry that even when you take CoQ10, are you taking enough to balance the depletion that's being caused in your mitochondria by the statin. So then there's statin brain, which is obviously a mitochondrial phenomenon. And there are people who get sore muscles and actually muscle damage from statins. In fact, a few people have gotten so much muscle damage that they took out their kidneys from all the broken muscle that got clogged up the kidney filter. So we don't want to give this to everybody. That would be bad because we would hurt people with the side effects. And yes, we would lower inflammation. My attitude is, yeah, fish oil, curcumin. There's other ways to lower inflammation that doesn't take away CoQ10, which you really need. And we should be pursuing those. And certainly for lowering cholesterol, by the way, if you take high-dose fish oil, you can lower cholesterol as much as a low dose of a statin, if you believe in lowering cholesterol does anything, but you're also just as anti-inflammatory or more than a statin. And for the last 20 years, you know, cardiologists, the ones who do the science, have known that inflammation is where this is at. This is not about cholesterol. Cholesterol is just what everyone has kind of focused on as a marker, but it's not the cause. It's a necessary ingredient, but it's not the cause.
You did come up with, when you were talking with her, she brought up something and you mentioned it that I've never heard of before, coronary calcium score.
Right.
Does that come in? Is that in a regular physical?
No. It's a special kind of CT test, and we typically do it when there's a family history of lots of heart attacks, but not high cholesterol.
Oh, it's CT.
It's a CT. It's a spiral CT. Yeah, and then they add up the amount of calcium, and the more calcium, the more, as I said, the more brittle the arteries, so the more likely that if you you'll get a crack and therefore
and
a heart attack.
Like a scan.
Yeah, it's a scan.
Yeah. Okay. One other question. I've got a cataract. I'm going to have it done. They've really got this knocked down? This is going to be the first time anybody has ever cut me.
I can understand
you're going to do this to my eye.
Yeah, I know. It's very psychologically fraught. They've got this so down. There are probably complications in the literature. I've been in medical practices for 25 years. I have literally never had anyone have a bad cataract surgery.
Okay, well, I'm going to see.
Yes, you are. You are going to see better. Okay.
Thank you a lot, Dr.
Bye-bye. And let's go on to Lee in Salinas, and that's number 4. Lee, you're on the air.
Dr. Dawn.
Yes, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for your helpful program. My question is, I have been diagnosed with ground glass nodules in my lungs, and I wonder what they are and how can they be treated?
Well, ground glass nodules that's kind of a radiologic description of what people see in their lungs, and it's associated with a couple of different diseases. So with your case, do you have any symptoms? What were they found on a routine chest X-ray, or do you have fevers, or did you have some kind of respiratory illness?
No, a CT scan 2 years ago showed several in the right and left lung, then I had a recent one 2 or 3 weeks ago, another CT follow-up scan, and there were more found. I'm not a smoker. The largest one was found, this recent test, on the left 7.7 millimeter diameter. And yes, I do have some discomfort. I won't say it's pain, but it's a discomfort that comes and goes in the left side, although there's a large, ill-defined 7 millimeter by 12 nodular on the right upper lobe. So I don't know. I hope to see a surgeon next week if he can get me in his office and find out what procedure he's recommending.
Well, I would say that, you know, these are lung nodules that I think we're seeing more and more of, and they're often up to, you know, 3 centimeters in diameter, and when you've got one of them, that's really quite a concern that it might be a cancer.
Mm-hmm.
When you have multiple ones, that starts to look a little bit spooky for metastasis, and so these generally are biopsied. I think that there have been some changes in the technology of what we do, and I'm just looking here. 31% of patients undergoing cardiac CT scans for coronary calcium have incidental findings of pulmonary nodules.
Mm-hmm.
So that they're not all obviously cancer. And did you ever live in the San Joaquin Valley?
No, never.
And because there's diseases like coccidioidomycosis and histoplasmosis that can show up as ground glass nodules as well. But basically, you've got granulomas, which are infections, and you've got lung cancers, and you've got some birth defects that can show up like this. And ultimately, if the nodule is a centimeter or larger, and I'm sorry, how large did you say you had?
Well, one of them, not a centimeter,
Oh, a millimeter.
Millimeter, 7.7. And another one is, it says numerous. And as I said, I had the first CT scan 2 years ago. The second one is 7 by 12 modular density at the right upper lobe.
7 by 12 millimeters. So you've got two, and you only had one on the previous CT?
No, I had numerous.
Okay.
On the previous. I think I had four on the left and six on the right.
And are they all still there? Have they changed?
They have not changed. The earlier ones have not changed.
But you got a new one?
I've got several new ones.
Okay. So now I understand. So essentially, this really does sound suspicious for an infectious granulomatous disease, a biopsy is in your future. What they'll probably do is go in through the, if you've got one that's near the outside of the lung, that's easy to get to, they'll probably try to go through the under the rib, mm-hmm. and get a needle using CT guidance into it and get a sample. And if they're all deep, then what they'll do is they'll find the one that's closest to one of the bronchioles, and then they'll do a bronchoscopy, and they'll go out sideways through the bronchiole and grab a piece of it. But you're going to need a tissue diagnosis. There are also some serology testing that an infectious disease doctor would probably do, testing you for cocci and histoplasmosis and maybe also sarcoid, but that would depend on whether you have lymph nodes.
Well, the other incidental finding was an aneurysm, 4.4 centimeters.
And this is in the chest or in the abdomen?
In the thoracic aorta.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a connection, the doctor wasn't even looking for that. But as you said, you take one scan and something else shows up that you weren't even looking for.
Always. This is one of the Murphy's laws of medicine, is that you do a test to try to reassure the patient and you find something, we call them incidental lomas. And then you end up spending all this time and money chasing the incidental loma to prove that it's not anything, even though you're completely asymptomatic and the only reason that you are chasing it is because you found it. But it's just the way of it.
The reading in my Merck book, it says that if the aneurysm, that is not six, I don't know whether they'll do anything.
No, they won't. They'll sit on it and monitor it,
uh-huh.
because you do not go in there unless it's ripe to rupture. And the magic number six is when, I think six is for abdominal. I'm not sure what the number is for thoracic, but the magic number six is when the probability of it rupturing spontaneously goes above, I think, 1 or 2% a year. Then at that point, 1 in 100 per year, we figure, well, I guess we better go in there. Generally, you want the mortality rate of the surgery to be smaller than the mortality rate of doing nothing.
Right.
And so I think they'll just monitor the aneurysm, and odds are it won't grow, or it won't grow fast.
The surgeon that I've been referred to is both a thoracic surgeon and a vascular surgeon.
Well, that's perfect, because he'll be able to give you a good opinion on both. But I can pretty much predict what's going to happen. It's pulmonary biopsy and leave the aneurysm alone. All right, I'm going to go on to our next callers, and thank you so much.
Thank you for your help.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And let's go on to Helen in Pacific Grove. Hello, Helen. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don. Thank you for taking my call. I was calling because I have a friend, I don't know her exact age, I would say maybe 70-ish, who has just come off chemo from lymphoma, and she's developed shingles.
Oh.
In her head.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if there's anything that you would recommend for, I don't know, ameliorating her symptoms. I guess it's quite painful and she's in a considerable discomfort.
Does she have thin hair?
Does she have thin hair?
Uh-huh.
She has very little hair because
Good.
She lost it in chemo.
Good. All right. So I would recommend a topical cream that can be made up by Loudon Pharmacy, and it contains, among other things, gabapentine and lidocaine, and you can also put some ketamine in there. And these are agents that stop the nerve from screaming.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, in scalp, I usually would put DMSO, which is a penetrating agent, because scalp is very thick, so mm-hmm. and the nerves are deep, so you want to essentially get a cream or a lotion on there that turns off the nerve, And because the nerves are damaged, and they're just going to scream like a colicky baby for months, and so you just go directly to the source, which is the nerve endings at the surface, and try to shut down some of that irritability. She should be on, and probably is on, a valacyclovir or another one of the agents related to that to help retard viral replication, and probably should stay on that at a preventative dose for a while, because it's not unheard of for this to bounce and recur. The other thing is that while it's on her scalp, she's at very high risk for developing it in her eyes. And so she needs to have an eye exam because it doesn't hurt in the eyes, but it can permanently scar the cornea.
Okay.
So her eyes need to be checked for involvement.
Okay. Very good. And the pharmacy was Loudon Pharmacy?
Right.
Where is that located?
Loudon's on 41st and Capitola here in Santa Cruz, or it's in Capitola, excuse me. And they will send a prescription form out to the doctor on request that explains what these compounds are and suggests the usage, and they've got one designed exactly for shingles.
Okay, I believe it's also on her face as well.
Yes, so well, that's why we have to be careful of the eye.
It would
be on her face because the same nerve that serves the scalp serves the face.
Okay, all right. So then if she contacts Loudon Pharmacy, they will...
It'd be better if she had her doctor contact Loudon Pharmacy.
Oh, of course. Okay, yeah. All right.
And just ask about the shingles creams, and they can fill them in. None of the proprietary pharmaceutical companies make anything close to this, and I found it to be quite efficacious. And the cool thing is you don't have to take something to knock you out. All of these drugs, gabapentin and the other ones that we use for orally for pain, for nerve pain, are sedatives. So people get zoned and zonked. And you know, if you can get your pain down to the point where it's tolerable without zonking your brain, that's the desirable one.
Yes. Yeah. Very good. Oh, well, thank you so very much.
You're welcome. All right.
That will be very helpful. I'm sure she's going to appreciate it greatly.
Glad I could help.
I don't know if you have time for one.
Real quick.
Real quick. Okay. My husband had a test for testosterone. I know you mentioned this briefly on your program last week. He was on the lower end of normal, and his chiropractor, interestingly, recommended that he take DHEA 25 milligrams.
Mm-hmm.
Is that any contraindications, or does that sound like a good idea?
Well, as long as he doesn't have prostate cancer, so I would make sure he has a normal PSA.
Right.
DHEA is a hormone by itself, but it is also raw material that will be converted by the body into testosterone. So it's an indirect way of raising testosterone, and that can be very helpful for low testosterone. Generally, you won't get much of a bump with the DHEA, maybe 5 points or 10 points on the testosterone score. So not going to really kick him up into the medium range under most circumstances. Depending upon whether he's symptomatic, it might be reasonable to consider actual testosterone supplementation, but that's beyond the scope of this program.
Sure. Okay.
All right.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for your help.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, time for one last caller. Oh, before we go to Bob, what dose of CoQ10 should I take if I'm on a low-dose statin? And I recommend 300 milligrams of ubiquinone, O-N-E, or 100 milligrams of ubiquinol, O-L. They're absorbed a little bit differently. Let's go to Bob in Pacific Grove. Hello, Bob. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Don. I'm 68 years old, and I'm still pretty active, but I believe I've had candida for the last nearly 20 years, and it's affected my feet where I get lesions and splits and chafing, and I do have toe fungal. But about a year ago, I started looking into the aspect of it being candida, learned that over 200 million Americans have candida. Is one statistic I came up with.
Yeah, I don't think that's a real statistic. But go ahead.
I guess my most direct question is I've been using, finally came to use oregano oil with coconut oil, and take about three drops of the oregano mixed in with the coconut oil twice to three times a day. And it's actually cleared it up where everything else seemed to get it under control for a while, but it would come back. The problems that I'm having is knowing what to eat and diet with. I'd lost 30 pounds, got up to about 220 pounds at one point, like 130 as a senior in high school at 6 feet tall. And I'm feeling good, except that reintegrating certain things into my diet is giving me a kind of a mind fog that I was eliminating by being on a strict diet. Any comments on that?
Yeah, well, the concept of Candida as being the culprit is the thing I have philosophical differences with. So I am very big on the microbiome, as you know, and I think of it as being sort of this happy jungle ecology. And then somebody comes in and, you know, strips down all the trees and the monkeys go away and plants palm oil plants, and then you've got this devastated monoculture. And in a devastated ecology, there are certain things that move in first, and yeast, Candida yeast, is one of them. A lot of alpha and gamma streptococcus move in. A lot of other bacteria that really should only be there in small amounts are there in large amounts, and the guys that should be there in large amounts, like the bifidobacterium and the lactobacillus, are absent or present in only small amounts, and you've got a disrupted ecology. And the symptoms of that are the symptoms of Candida. And so what happens, I think, is that back in a time when we didn't have such a sophisticated understanding of this, you would find that you could grow Candida from the stool of people who had the symptoms. And so you made the sort of simplistic assumption that the Candida was the cause of all these symptoms. I sort of see the Candida as being a component of a manifestation of a disrupted ecology. So it's there because the guys that should be keeping it out aren't there. Rather like Candida in the vagina. If a woman has enough lactobacillus in her vagina, she doesn't have Candida because the lactobacillus keeps it out. But if you give her antibiotics for a bladder infection, she'll often get a yeast infection because the small amounts of yeast present in her colon inhabit her vagina because the lactobacillus isn't there to keep it out. I'd love to talk more about this, but I think in general we have to kind of wrap it up because we've reached the end of our hour. But I think the oregano oil and coconut oil treatment that you're doing is fine. If you'd like to call back, we'll be here next week. We're doing a special on CRISPR-Cas9, but we'll be back the week after that. So if you want to pick it up at the end of the month, I'd be happy to talk with you further on diet.
All right. Thank you. I'll call back.
Thanks. Bye-bye. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.